to delay.
That's all we can do.
So I think, in short, the answer is it depends, and it's very difficult to define a spatial, the extent of the issue in a spatial sense. I think it's the advisory circular gives an example of the highest recorded bird strike was at 30,000 feet or more. It was very high. So, and the advisory circular doesn't define the issue by spatial extent. And speaking to the relevant person at the airport who we were just speaking to, he indicated that it's an issue that varies by season, time of day, that most bird strike, or most reported bird strike, is on the airfield. But that, I think, reflects how the reporting that has been carried out to date, and more recently reports are, the reporting is looked more widely, and reports are coming in from pilots who have near misses much further afield. So the which is why QAC is seeking the relief it is, to have a policy or matter of discretion, which flags the issue, so then so a case by case assessment can be undertaken at the time the application is made. And it might be that the council receives an application and thinks, well, is this proposal going to give rise to a bird strike issue? Has a discussion with the QAC or the relevant person might be, and that case by case assessment can be undertaken at that time. And I think that's probably as far as it can be defined at this stage. It will depend on a whole range of matters, which may not be that helpful for you, sorry, but take it.
Any questions arising?
No, thanks.
This is wondering, what you might not be able to answer, but I'm interested in that conversation you just had. When the pilots were reporting near misses, was there any particular areas of concern, or was it just a pretty general concern throughout the whole area, or is there approaches in the Waikato or Wanaka which are more of concern than others?
Well, the conversation we're having focused on Queenstown, and my understanding is that there's a consistent flight path that's used into Queensland Airport, and that generally tracks down the Kawara River, and hawks are a big issue there, and at other times of year other types of birds can be an issue, also now at twilight bird strike is going to become an increasing issue now that Queensland Airport has commenced evening flights. So I think the reporting comes from the flight path and it relates to the flight paths that are flowing. So the planes start to zoom around the basin, avoiding birds, they follow the flight path, and birds do fly within those flight paths. But there's no particular area where there's exposition than others.
Thank you.
Sorry, that's not actually correct. There are areas where it is an issue more than others as a result of existing waterways, and that is the river and the storm detention. Sorry, the wastewater detention, wastewater ponds there, and the birds track across to Jack's Point, Charlene's farm. I think the issue is that the birds will go where the water is, so it could become an issue in other areas if it's not properly managed. Do you require anything else, Martin?
Do you have any more questions?
Only one. I wonder if you could introduce the third member of your team.
Oh, sorry. This is Ms. Needham. She is Adrian was talking about the action, that's the name of
Needham.
Needham. So she's a law clerk, rather.
Thanks.
She will be presenting submissions later on, please.
We both look forward to it.
Sorry, what was that?
We both look forward to it.
Yeah, I'm sure she does too.
Not Stevens will be there or not, we'll see.
Do you need anything in writing?
No, that's a special thing. That's why I thought it was more official to do it.
You said
to
that,
yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm a planner from Patterson Pitts, Parks here in Wanaka. I have with me Mike Botting, who is a part of Patterson Pitts Group, holds a bachelor's survey degree, and is a registered professional surveyor. He is a specialist in land development and has been the lead designer and project manager for the Peninsula Bay and Riverside developments, and has worked in Wanaka since 2004. Prior to joining Patterson Pitts, and worked in the same field for 6 years in Auckland. And I'm not sure if you have received evidence from any other surveyors or land development engineers in relation to Chapter 27. So I thought it might be a good idea to bring him along so you can ask proper practitioner in this field any questions that you might have that haven't been covered by any other evidence.
Thank you, Mr. White, because surprisingly, Mr. Botting is the first surveyor that has come into the hearing room.
I'm quite
sharp
about that.
We've got a lot of lawyers who claim to be experts on subdivision. There's one or two planners, but no. Thank you.
The evidence I'm about to present has been prepared on behalf of Patterson Pitts in support of the company's submission, which was submission 453. I've outlined all of the issues in the evidence in front of you, but I don't propose to go through all of those today because a lot of them are just stating that we've reviewed the section 42A and 32 reports and are happy with a lot of changes that have been made as a result of this submission. This, in relation to section 3 on page 3 of the evidence, in relation to issues 1 to 3 of the section 42A report, the state of the subdivision, the submission from Patterson Pitts opposed the identification of most forms of subdivision as discretionary activities and sought that complying subdivisions, boundary adjustment subdivisions, and subdivisions around existing buildings should instead be controlled activities. The recommended change to a generally restricted discretionary regime for subdivision is supported, as the provisions allowing the update of existing cost leases and unit titles for permitted activities and certain types of boundary adjustments to occur as controlled activities. The recommendation for subdivisions in accordance with a structured plan or spatial layout plan controlled activities are also supported. Restricted discretionary activity status for subdivisions in urban zones and rural living zones is also supported. In relation to issue 6, the infill development provisions, the changes to rule 27.7.13, which is our submission point 4.3.4, are are supportive. However, the changes that the Section 42A and Section 52A reports don't address sufficient points 453.5 on Rule 27.7.4. And I'm not allowed to get that ruled out.
Just as a clarification, that's 27.7.14 as per the revised version.
All the number in here is as per the revised.
Thank you.
The 29th of July. Sufficient point supported the intent of this rule, but sought further consideration of the practicalities associated with it, particularly those raised by the note between clauses B and C of that rule. These practicalities appear not to have been considered yet. Primarily, the Section 24C certificate, and that's the certificate issued by Council to demonstrate that the conditions of the subdivision consent have been complied with, is a prerequisite to the issue of a new computer freehold register or allotments created as part of the subdivision. A consent notice under Section 321 of the Act is normally registered at the time a new CFR is issued, and this is always after the issue of the 24C certificate. This issue could easily be resolved by following amendment to the wording of this clause, removing the word wording prior to certification under Section 24C and replacing wording on certificate title with a new name for a certificate title, which is a computer freehold register. This amendment is a simple change to the wording of the rule only, and so would not add any additional costs. It would make the text become more accurate as well as being more efficient and effective.
Can ask a question on that? I'm just I understand the issue that you're raising. I'm just wondering whether another solution would be to make it a standard that on the section 139 stability compliance there be a condition attached that those be included as a consent notice on the title. Because the Act seems to provide that where the plan contains such a condition, the stability compliance shall include it.
Okay, that's one of the circumstances in it. We have applied for a certificate of compliance for a proposed building.
Yeah, and if a consent grant, it's not a problem because it will be a condition on the consent. So it's just a matter of I can see what you're getting at with those two, and it's a matter of making sure that in both circumstances that those conditions are attached to the provision so that they automatically flow through.
That seems sensible.
Mm. Okay.
So can you repeat your solution that Mr. White has just agreed with? If I can write this down.
Section 139, subsection 10 seems to provide the answer for certificate of compliance circumstances.
Thank you.
The same submission point also note that the consent notice is an enduring memorial on a CFR, and in this case would require ongoing compliance with a certain house design approved by resource consent or a certificate of compliance. There may be other house designs that achieve the same or better outcomes for that site and would be just as suitable but the consent notice in this area or cancelled under section 221.3 requires ongoing compliance with an approved outcome. Similarly, any alteration to a house subject to such a consent notice would require a variation or cancellation of that consent notice. One way to avoid this issue may be to register a generic consent notice referring to approved plans rather than a specific reference to an approved set of plans. And one other issue that we've noted in the final sentence there is what happens if a vacant site is created but not built on for more than 5 years, by which time the consent or the certificate of compliance for the house has lapsed and therefore may require another consent in order to establish the same house or a different house. I'm also a little bit concerned about the registration of consent notices to secure short-term requirements, because the wording of section 221 is specific to requiring ongoing compliance with the conditions of a subdivision consent. For instance, in this case, the construction of an approved house or forming a vehicle crossing would be an incorrect use of the consent notice, as they're not ongoing requirements, they're a one-off requirement. So in this case, you build a house or vehicle crossing, and therefore you don't need the consent notice anymore, because that condition of consent has been complied with. I also note that there's normally no requirement for subdivisions to be subject to consent notices requiring compliance with district plan rules, those required by clauses D and E of this rule. I consider that the long-term costs associated with the and the cancellation or variation of consent notice to the landowner set up by the short-term benefit from the registration of consent notice. And one technique to avoid the situation, as we discussed in the previous paragraph, is the registration of a generic consent notice referring to approved plans rather than specific reference to an approved set of plans. Also note that clauses D and E are the requirements of a proposed rule in the plan, and you might need to consider those again in light of your hearing on that issue. In the final paragraph, the final sentence of that paragraph, I've said the rule, the intent of the rule is supported, but the mechanics, practicalities and effects of it need a little more consideration.
Another, just looking again at the rule, another question is whether the more practical solution is to not allow section 224C until the building is constructed to the point that it has the roof on or something like that. Something similar to what you have under the Unit Titles Act, where there has to be the structure in place, then you don't need the consent notice in respect of that, you need the consent notice to deal with the height, because that would be a long-term issue.
We can see exactly what Council is trying to achieve with this, and we do support it, and we do see that it would be beneficial to our clients to be able to do it. It's just that the mechanics of it need to
change. Yes.
You know, capital outlay to build a building first. It'd be better for a lot of developers to be able to title the vacant section and get funding from their bank to then build it, as opposed to trying to build the buildings first and then subdivide. It makes it a wee bit easier in terms of their cash flow. Certainly, you know, it's, I think the existing district plan has that requirement anyway at the moment to have the buildings built.
I understand that. I wonder if the real problem is this idea that you need to have a building design committed to have that size site from a development point of view, provided there's sufficient, you have a minimum lot size which we need to deal with in the residential area. Would it be more sensible just to allow the subdivision and then build to fit the site?
Yeah, if you can prove that you can fit a building on the vacant lots and comply with all the rules in terms of the recession lines, etc., it's fine. You know, someone doesn't necessarily need to build that house, they know they can fit something on that site if it's a certain shape. perhaps where the circumstance though is here arising where you've got an internal boundary where you give yourself consent for infringement, those infringements would need to be registered on a consent notice so that you give the long-term approval, because if the lots are sold and then they're a different ownership and say the resource consent expired, well then you might not be able to get approval from that new owner. So
that could be done by covenant though, couldn't it?
Yes.
The council doesn't have to be involved in it.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, it just needs to be a mechanism as part of the subdivision, so not necessarily need to be a consent notice. Just to make sure you secure the actual ability to build if the site's tight. So that can be done by different means.
Is the reality that you could achieve the same thing by having maximum dimensions, any subset of which would be acceptable?
We've done that, haven't we, in our recent developments in Tempe Street, where they defined a building envelope and actually narrowed the recession lines and maximum heights on some of the internal boundaries. And that they were registered, I'm not sure if they were covenant or consent notice.
But certainly a private covenant, and that may have come down as a consent notice as well. That's the subdivision on the primary school site.
I thought Commissioner Robinson up there to have a look at those.
Right.
Early this morning, so he's familiar with some of the places in the Middle Bay, and several other places, parts of Wanaka, so he knew what we'd be talking about.
It certainly gives you more flexibility then when you go to build in the future, you're not tied to design, but yeah, you can be tied to a building envelope, which would be a much better outcome, I think.
But doesn't the district plan, no density or medium or high density, zone tie to certain dimensions anyway? I mean, you've got your setback distances.
Yes,
well,
this rule, of course, is in the low density zone, and it's to continue the facilitation of the 450 square metre. But the question that arises in my mind is whether we need to start with a 900 square metre lot or whether we can just create the 450. And with having generic building designs, you know, that the site is capable of containing a building of some sort of remote, rather than having, I'm not sure that you need to have a building consent to get down to 450 square metres as well.
No, I don't think you do.
I can think of other councils around the place that have you can go down as low as 400 square metres as a vacant site, but below that, they require a specific design and the house to be under construction to reform stage before you can subdivide.
So, is my understanding correct that if the issue is that you're being tied to a particular design, you would solve that by having an outer envelope?
Yes.
The next submission points relate to the objectives and policies which are issue 9 in section 42 of our own report. In relation to policy 27.2.1.1, relates to subdivision code of practice. Patterson Pitts submitted against the original wording of this policy, but is now satisfied with the amended wording, so it does not make specific reference to the subdivision code of practice. As per the submission, concern raised by the submission is still around the process and reasons to and the ability for key stakeholders to provide input on changes to the code of practice. It's recognised that the ability for key stakeholders to provide input changes to the code of practice is an issue that's outside the district plan process.
Yeah, well, we do have some quite concerns about the that process that's outside the district plan in terms of what changes can be made. It's a bit of a tough one, really. A lot of it, I feel, from referring to the evidence of David Wallace, the reason for seems to be around mainly around in relation to transport issues with Woodford Roads, which, for example, is referred to as one of the justifications for going to a restricted discretionary status. that seems to be the only justification that he can provide in terms of an engineering basis, but I would have thought that the issues around roading could be covered off in the transport section around road widths. And that's probably something that will be covered off in the transport section.
I think, from my understanding of Mr. Wallace's evidence, was that the road widths and the code of practice is what they want to rely on rather than putting them in the district plan.
Yeah, there is a bit of a difference between a private woods, for example, and what's in the code of practice, and trying to align the two would be good. I think that code of practice does achieve a better outcome in terms of low impact design, reducing the widths of driveways, example, as opposed to the wider width in the current plan.
I think the other, in terms of the restricted discretionary, I did raise the issue of a hearing that I'd had in Arthur's Point with Mr. Goldsmith, where Mr. Goldsmith had actually acted for the applicant, where land had been landlocked because the controlled activity subdivision had been designed in such a way that it didn't actually allow. Technically, the land had access, but it didn't have access that enabled it to be developed, and of course, the council couldn't turn down the other subdivision. So I think there was agreement. And Mr. Goldsmith, the restrictive discretion at least enabled those circumstances to be dealt with.
That's actually a fair point. That's almost a form of a spite strip by disguise, I guess.
Yes, and I think it was unintentional.
Okay. But unintentional, it probably wasn't picked up at the time, I guess, by then.
Well, I don't know what it's all about, yes, but.
But at any rate, I think there needs to be some further discussion outside this in terms of how that code of practice can be changed, and whether and it's good for us to actually as stakeholders to have an involvement in that process. It does raise some concerns, you know, that a council engineer could just change something without fully realising what the implications of that change could have on our clients in terms of cost and also certainty as well. So I'm not sure how that can be resolved. The current code of practice could just be changed overnight and we don't know about the change, and we provide advice saying that you can subdivide to a certain width and standard and suddenly find out we can't do it.
It's a bit like development contributions, isn't it?
Yeah, we'll come off that shortly. And Rob, maybe that's something you can take back and discuss back to the engineers.
In relation to policy 27.2.12, which is the subdivision side pipeline, as with the previous issue, the submission on this point is concerned more about the lack of involvement in the process of formulating the subdivision design guidelines, and as a result of that, the guideline has not been through a public process, but effectively will become part of the district plan.
Although, effectively, this is your opportunity. In the same way that the Arrowtown design guidelines are going through variation 1 to be included in the district plan, and so if people have lodged submissions on the subdivision design guidelines, then we will have to deal with those, but I doubt that very many have.
My question was going to be, have you received any submissions on the design guidelines?
Yes, Clark Fortune McDonald.
Right. I'll just say, I quite like the cover on this one, because it's actually one of my subdivisions. It's actually the Riverside subdivision.
Right.
And there's actually a few more pictures of ones that I've been involved in here. I'll read through it. A lot of it is pretty obvious, I mean, from in terms of what we do. But it's good to actually convey to even a layperson, you know, the process and what gets considered when we do a subdivision. So a lot of it's actually quite good, I think. The example site of Skir Heights, having known the site, the design outcomes on there probably don't reflect the true nature.
There are a few more lumps in it.
The arrow's going in the wrong direction in terms of flow downhill, flow uphill in the case of the pictures in there. One thing we had some questions around and discussion in our office was around on page 7 of that design guideline, around street and loft orientation and layout, around the last paragraph about minimise earthworks and disrupting the landform. And then it's got two bullet points there about designing the layout of roads and lots to fit with the natural character and topography of the site. And then seems to be then conflicted straight away by avoid situations where significant post-subdivision development earthworks will be required to create building platforms and driveways. Take Alpha Ridge, I've seen Alpha Ridge up there. The site topography still slopes from high from the south to the north, being lower. However, they've done a lot of earthworks and have benched it. The earthworks benching is probably avoided to meet that second requirement. And I suppose the topography is still being the first one if you're still generating slopes from south to north. But it's getting the right balance, and what we've found is that recently, more at the lower level, and maybe it's more guidance is needed to be passed down to the people processing the consents, is that we're building subdivisions for people to live in and build houses on. You can't retain the full natural character. You're going to cover up houses, especially when you start dealing with medium density, when you're going to have a lot more denser housing. In order to build the houses, you have to do a lot of earthworks to create benched sites. So there is a bit of a conflict there, and maybe just some, we need to be careful how much reliance we need to place on the statements such as this in this design guideline. Otherwise, I think it's got some very good points in it. On page 9, it makes reference to drainage swales and detention ponds. Doesn't seem to be any mention of water quality. It's more focused on water quantity and attenuating it. I think the bigger issue should be water quality and treatment. Take, for example, water quantity going into the lakes or a large river like the Clutha River. The quantity is not really an issue. The level of Wanaka is driven by the large rivers that flow into it, whereas water quality is. And example of what we've done in the past is at Peninsula Bay, when we focus on using swales for treatment and stormwater ponds for treatment. We didn't actually do any attenuation. We have a system set up where the what's called the first flush gets treated, and that's as the rain increases, it cleans the roads and washes the roofs, and all that low flow gets diverted to the swales. And if the flood or if the storm gets in a higher intensity, the larger flow can bypass the treatment devices. And so long as the downstream receiving environment can handle it, there's no issue, no need to provide attenuation. So I don't know if council's focus is correct in terms of only focusing on attenuation. I think there needs to be a focus on water quality.
Mm. That should be true in Queenstown as well?
Yes. Yeah, the receiving environments of the Wakatipu and Shotover and Kawara aren't driven by any increase in runoff. You know, just even take the airport. Mm. You know, the last expensive runway isn't going to flood the Kawara.
And Lake Hayes already has a quality problem.
Yeah, so it's quality is more the issue, I think, it needs to be focused on. And you can assess that attenuation requirement on a case-by-case basis. Say, take Bullet Creek, both problems, you want high water quality and you want to attenuate. You don't want to be putting either of those two into Bullet Creek. But if you're discharging straight into Clutha River, just water quality would be sufficient.
The next submission point, 4.3.17, support the green number policy 27.4.4.6, with additional wording to recognise that land set aside as reserve in order to protect and enhance landscape vegetation to just biodiversity should be credited against the reserve land component of development contribution. The section 22A report rejects this suggestion and other submissions on the same policy on the basis that that makes the policy more effective. Having looked at this proposed policy again and reviewed it in light of the removal of council development contribution policy, I now question whether this policy is required at all, given this is a matter specifically addressed in development contribution policy. Perhaps it would be more efficient and effective and avoid overlaps between the district plan and the development contributions policy to leave the consideration of specific development contributions outside the district plan by removing clause 2 of the policy entirely.
Yeah,
Yes.
Submission 453.0, opposed policy 27.2.59, on the basis that such man is the best addressed to the common building. The submission point has been rejected. But this report has not recognised that there's an overlap between this policy and 27.2.5 and 4. So this, I consider this provision not required. The submission also opposed policy 27.5.1, as with policy 27.46 above. This is a matter specifically addressed in development contributions
Mr.
policy.
Mr. White, can you just move the microphone slightly towards you, because you're rather quieter than Mr. Bocking. I want to make sure that it's recorded.
In relation to the submission on policy 27.2.5.1, as with policy 27.4.6, this is a matter specifically addressed in the development contributions policy. Perhaps it would be more efficient and effective and avoid overlaps to move the consideration of specific development contributions outside the district plan by removing their policy entirely. The submission opposed the renumbered policy 27.5.16 and sought to have upgrades credited against development contributions, but the original wording can be supported provided policy 27.5.11 is deleted on the basis that Council's development contribution policy and subdivision code of practice covers the standards for the upgrades and the offsetting of costs associated with these against development contributions payable. Do you have any questions on the submission in relation to development contributions? Then the final 2 points, the point 6 and 7, support for the change to proposed 5.17 and relating to the non-notification of applications that involve in the discretionary activities.
Do you have any questions?
No.
Thank you. I'll ask you all the questions that are right. Report was early three. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Bridget Irving. I'm a partner at Galloway McCallum and I'm appearing today on behalf of Aurora Energy Limited. I have Nick Wyatt with me. Nick is a power systems engineer for Aurora, and he's really come to just assist me in case there's any technical questions about the network that I'm unable to answer. So I circulated yesterday the responses from Ms. Dowd to your question, and also my legal submission. There were a couple of matters that you've seen from further discussion at Aurora about Ms. Dowd's responses, just in relation to two of the critical lines that had been identified. Specifically, the 11 kV overhead line to Glenorchy. Ms. Dowd recorded that as an 11 kV line, which is correct currently, although that line has been insulated to be able to cope with 33 kV, and it is expected with the projected demand growth along that line that within the next 10 years it will essentially begin transmitting at 33 kV. So that influences the setback width that we would like for that particular line. And the same applies in relation to the 11 kV line out to Treble Cone. So that runs from Wanaka here out past Glendoo to Treble Cone. It is also the line that is, will supply Parkins Bay. And so depending on potential development at the Spearfield itself, but also the development that may occur at Parkins Bay, that line may also be 33 kV by the next district plan review.
Just excuse me for a little bit of curtains across.
No. Yes, I had some experience on my drive up here today.
We had a discussion before lunch about the frequency that Dunedin sees a clear sky.
Well, at the moment it's not. It's beautiful weather. So other than those couple of things, I don't propose to run through my legal submissions again, unless you would like me to. But just happy to answer any questions that you may have.
I just have some queries on the first thing. It's more of information, and paragraph 2 of Ms. Dow's reply, answer to questions. She talks about the earthworks chapter being open for review. I'm advised by the council's solicitor at the opening for this stream of hearings that will not be open for review. It will be treated as operative.
Right.
So. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, that is what it is, I suppose.
Yeah.
From Aurora's perspective, I think that makes the changes that we're seeking in relation to this section perhaps even more important, because there's less potential for these issues to be addressed by that other section of the plan. So, I mean, Aurora may like to consider, having received that information, whether it could perhaps initiate a private change to the earthworks section if it was particularly concerned about earthworks and providing for reverse sensitivity. So we may need to think about that a bit more deeply in light of what you've just told me. But,
Now, just in Table 1, I just wanted to clarify that there's the dual circuits running into Wanaka, there's UC66-1. That runs through the middle of three parks at the moment. Is that going to be realigned?
It's actually the Upper Clutha 2 line that runs through three parks.
Is it the Upper Clutha one that goes through?
Yes. And there are plans to realign that, which we're working through at the moment.
So
can you repeat that? Sorry, I was trying to. Which line is going through?
The Upper Clutha 66 number 2. So that travels on, say, at the east side of Flat Dunstan all the way up and then through Luggett.
In terms of the use in that table of private land, does that include dockland?
Some of it's dockland, yes.
So, just on the Makarora one, that might be a large amount of dockland to Makarora, might it?
Yes.
Rather than private land.
Mm-hmm.
The other question I've got is a legal question. I'm going to ask it before Commissioner Robinson does, but it's quite a straightforward one. It's Why does Aurora not use its powers as the requiring authority to impose rules in relation to those lines, in the same way that airports impose rules in areas surrounding the airport on heights of buildings, etc.?
In terms of essentially designation?
Yes.
Yeah. We had that same question when we appeared before the Dunedin City panel.
Unsurprisingly.
And I think it isn't something that Aurora have really considered at this point. The designation process, I think, as I set up in my little submission, is seen as perhaps being a little bit, I think I used the term that taking the speech and to apply, in the sense that it is perhaps perceived as being more restrictive and affecting the ability of landowners to use their land in a more sort of regulatory way than this alternative. And really the reason that Aurora are seeking the identification of those critical lines and the rule framework to go with that is not because we want to put blanket controls on that land within those corridors, but it's really about flagging to people what their obligations are in the vicinity of those critical lines. And there are already regulations in place through the code, but as a general rule, people don't realise. And what we find is that people obtain resource consents or building consents to develop inside the areas that would breach the code, and then of course they are rather shocked when Aurora says, look, I'm sorry, but you can't do that.
But wouldn't the designation solve that problem? Because they'd have to have the approval of the requiring authority,
yes,
before they could get the consent or implement it.
Yes. I mean, yes, it would work, but the rule framework in the corridor is the way that we've chosen to pursue it at the moment.
Ms. Irwin, earlier today, the representatives of Federated Farmers pitched to us quite strongly the suggestion that if people don't know about their obligations under these regulations, perhaps it's Aurora's job to be telling them about it, given that it's Aurora's assets that are sitting on their private land.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your reaction to that?
Aurora does try to make people aware of what their obligations are, but I'm sure you'll appreciate that, you know, their network is expansive, and people's the ownership of land changes, you know, can change quite frequently, and so no matter how much you know, public awareness campaigns Aurora runs on these sorts of things, we're not always going to be able to make everyone aware of what their obligations are. So my response, I suppose, to Federated Farmers' concern is we are already doing that, but our observation is that people are more aware of and have to engage with the resource management process and district plans than they do with a relatively obscure Electricity Act regulation. And so this is really about providing a parachute to make people aware of that and capture those proposals before people get right through a development process and have consents in hand, to then be told, look, I'm sorry, you can't do what you wanted to do. So it's really about trying to improve awareness of those obligations so that people can actually design around those at the front end rather than having to come back later and do something different.
Can I just follow on to Commissioner Robinson's question? Just another point that Federated Farmers Augustine sort of brought up was alignment with the neighbouring districts of Queensland Lakes, such as Central Otago District. Do you feel that what you've put in the submission for Queensland Lakes is consistent with what's in operation in Central Otago?
It's not currently. Central Otago are a little bit further behind in terms of their district plan process. I think they've begun their sort of early work on their review. Aurora's plan is to seek these types of rules throughout its network. So we've made similar submissions in relation to Dunedin City. We will make similar submissions in relation to CODC and a small area of Southland that we have part of our network within. So our hope would be that across the network we will have a consistent suite of provisions. But that will be a sort of progressive exercise as each district goes through its review process.
Thank you.
I have an issue, or a question from New Zealand. I wanted to pose about your discussion of the proposed regional policy statement, in particular objective 3.5, which introduces the concept of nationally and regionally significant infrastructure, and in relation to the transmission of electricity, the term of art is electricity transmission infrastructure, which is the same term that's used in the NPSET and defined to mean the national grid. So is your submission that that term has a different meaning in the context of Objective 3.5 and the policies that relate to it, or is it restricted to the national grid?
It's perhaps a little ambiguous in the sense that it talks about infrastructure of both national and regional significance. And so I think from that we can take that that is not intended to apply to the national grid only, that that's a wider provision than simply the national grid. I can't recall off the top of my head what submissions Aurora made in relation to that specific objective in relation to the proposed policy statement, but my suspicion is that we would have sought changes to ensure that the distribution network was recognised. And I think as you see, look through objective 3.6 and 3.6.5, there is their recognition of both the transmission and the distribution network. But I accept perhaps certainly objective 3.5 is a little ambiguous.
And I'll put to you the same question I put to Federated Farmers. Given the obligations of this panel vis-à-vis the proposed regional policy statement, at the moment, to have particular regard to it, but in the fullness of time when it's operative to give effect to it. If those policies are shifted, that they do, perhaps accepting your point that it arguably ambiguous at the moment, that it's made clearer that it's just the national grid, would you accept that in terms of our having particular regard to that and or giving effect to it, we would necessarily have to follow that lead?
That's a good question. I don't think so, and I would say that. I think you have an obligation, I suppose, in your own mind to assess whether or not the infrastructure that Aurora is seeking to have identified is critical to the well-being of the Queenstown district. I think that assessment is made more straightforward, perhaps, if the regional policy documents identify regionally significant infrastructure is including the distribution network. But I don't think that's determinative in terms of your assessment. And I think what we have sought to do through our evidence is to demonstrate that in terms of the contribution to the well-being of the Queenstown Lakes community, the critical electricity lines that we have identified are very important to that. And so irrespective of those wider issues, they are deserving of protection.
Another point that arises from the RPS is that you've omitted the provisions that talk about managing the effects of infrastructure on natural and physical resources, and minimising the effects generally. In terms of reverse sensitivity, doesn't it work both ways, that your lines are having reverse sensitivity effects on farming activities over which they run that you ought to be reducing or minimising?
yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I think to the extent that Aurora can minimise the effects of its infrastructure, it does through its engineering design, and through simply trying to build a network that is resilient, that it's safe, it's capable of handling the different types of weather conditions and so on. That is essentially enhanced, and I suppose this is where it works in both ways as well, by the network not being put at risk by activities that go on around it. Then there is conversely less potential for adverse effects on those other activities, whether it's, you know, trees nearby that may light fires and all of those kinds of things. So I think kind of whichever way you look at it, there is mutual benefits in protecting the infrastructure to avoid adverse effects on surrounding activities and equally controlling the surrounding activities to avoid the effects on infrastructure.
Well, cutting to the chase, would you need a smaller buffer if you undergrounded those lines?
I'll leave that to Nick, I think.
We would still need to obviously get in there and maintain them. So that's always critical. I'm not aware of any easement where we haven't allowed ourselves a new line, but we haven't allowed ourselves the ability to access and dig up. Because obviously when it faults and people's power is out, we're legally obligated to get it back on properly.
Clearly you need access over the actual line, but the question is, how big a space either side would you need?
It depends on the situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's a horses for courses question to an extent. I mean, the standard easements that we require in terms of a corridor for an underground line is essentially 1.5 metres either side of the line. For the more significant lines where we've got redundancies, so there's essentially two lines, those easement corridors need to be wider. Where you've got steeper country, of course, you need more space to be able to get in and maintain. So in that sense, it's site-specific. I mean, a blanket requirement to underground Aurora's infrastructure is just, I mean, it's just not achievable given the type of topography and countryside that we're dealing with in Queenstown. And the cost that would then give rise to for the community in terms of what line charges would subsequently have to be in order to fund that is, I mean, you just never even do it.
I suspect it would also take more years than Mr. Wyatt has before retirement before it could be achieved.
Yeah, I mean,
there's some very serious technical issues you'd have to overcome in undergrounding vast rural networks.
And in terms of the discussion in your submissions about other options for protecting infrastructure, Ms. Dowd has helpfully given us some commentary in relation to the extent to which the larger lines, larger transmission lines, are on road reserve or on private land. Can you give me any sense of the smaller lines, the ones less than 11 kV? Are they typically on road reserve, or is there no rule of thumb?
So your low voltage lines,
yes,
will typically run down a street, and then obviously at the boundary, it's entering private property to feed that house. So it is a dedicated feed to that one supply.
In rural areas?
In rural areas. So that's, it's all obviously a technical issue around getting appropriate voltage to people. So we will have high voltage lines at 11 kV running into people's properties. And then usually the low voltage will be quite limited because it will be a dedicated transformer to their house. So yes, you will have a mixture of 11 kV and low voltage on rural private properties.
So should I write in my note that in urban areas, typically they'll be on road reserve apart from an individual house connection, but it's much more varied in rural areas?
Yes.
And I mean, that's more so too with as people need higher voltage supply for irrigations and so on. So increasingly, there's a need for high voltage equipment within private land. Where that's going in now, of course, Aurora is obtaining easements to protect that infrastructure. But where that infrastructure existed pre 1992, it's protected by way of the statutory easements under the Electricity Act. And I suppose the vast bulk of the network at the moment is pre 1992. So, as a matter of course, when there are significant upgrades being done on those parts of the network, Aurora endeavours to get easements in place. That's always possible, in which case it relies on its existing use rights under the Electricity Act.
Just following on from that, I take it from Mr. Wyatt's response that therefore the maps attached to the submission, those are the only 11 kV lines that Aurora are concerned about?
Not at all.
So there's a lot more lines,
yes,
that would be caught by these provisions?
Very much so.
No, because we're only identifying those lines, so the lines only apply, the rules only apply to the critical electricity lines.
Right.
The reason that we've chosen those lines, for the higher voltage ones, it's because of the volume of people that that's supplying. For the lower voltage lines, it's generally got to do with the fact that the communities that those lines are serving are isolated. We don't have the same options available to us to provide supply via alternative routes if there's a fault. And so it's very important that those lines remain as resilient as possible. And that's the case for those 11 kV lines. The other 11 kV lines within the district, obviously we will, at an operational level, want to continue to protect those to the extent we can, but we didn't think that the risks to those lines were such that it justified the protection being conferred through the critical electricity line rules and plan. So we've just chosen sort of it's essentially 10% of the network within Queenstown that is either particularly important or particularly vulnerable for protection.
have a question about how it's operated today. To what extent has the absence of provisions, such as those you're seeking, been a practical problem for these critical lines to date?
There have been a number of instances where people have not been aware of their obligations under the code, and as a result we now have situations where there is underbuild under those lines, which creates potential risk and difficulty in the event of a fault. Essentially, where that has happened, it is now an exercise in managing that as best as we can. That may involve sort of upgrading or altering the way that those sections of lines work, or when the opportunity arises, trying to take those lines away from that risk. But obviously that comes at cost and the potential risk to those lines in the interim. So we basically manage it where that has happened. We try and prevent it where we become aware of it before development occurs. And that's just, I suppose, one of those day-to-day things that Aurora tries to manage.
I suppose, like I'm Wellington-based, and I can visualise transpower lines running through the Wilton Valley over the top of houses. So presumably, this is not a, well, I put it more open than that. Is that a management choice? Or to what extent is it directed by the code?
What do you mean by management choice?
That Ms. Irving has said, well, you'd look to manage it, you'd look to shift it, but desirably you want to stop it before it becomes an issue. The advice you've given us is that it's a problem in fault conditions, but as I say, I can visualise national grid lines that are going over houses in urban Wellington. And so, well, to be frank, there is a does not compute in going on in my mind. So I'm looking for an explanation of, as to, well,
how do they?
Well, not so much how did it happen, but well, why hasn't Transpower come to the same conclusion that you're saying that Aurora would come to and would now be looking at shifting its lines?
Yeah, I think it's a little harsh to say that we just want to stop it outright.
I'm not saying that.
We'd want to work with whoever's wanting to develop to make sure that we could still maintain and they are aware of how close they can go. I know we get very seldom questions about how close they can approach lines, and we're happy to deal with that and talk through options, put forward costs on moving that asset or undergrounding it. But it really does become a compliance cost for us if someone's put something underneath our line or come so close that they want to paint their house and we'd have to turn a high voltage line off to a community just so they can paint the site safely.
I think, Commissioner, it depends a little on what else is happening in the network. In the examples that you refer to in Wellington, it's quite possible that Transpower may have redundancy elsewhere that would allow them to essentially turn off that section, redirect power to maintain that part of the line. So it depends on the nature of the network in a particular location about how much flexibility you have to manage those issues. And so that's perhaps the reason that Transpower can allow or there are houses under lines in those instances. So, yeah, in urban environments, it's perhaps a little bit different because you have a much higher density of a network, so you do have more options available to you in redirecting and so on when you need to undertake maintenance works.
I think these might be the main lines from the DC connection under the Strait to Haywards.
They'll still have redundancy in that though. So.
Their own sister redundancy.
Yeah.
North Island go short.
You bother us.
Just,
have you finished that sentence?
Yes, yes, I have.
Just going back to your earlier comments, that it's a matter of people being aware of what the standards are. If that's the case, then it doesn't really require any rules in the plan, does it?
Well, it may not. The identification of the lines in reference to the code might be enough. But certainly people tend to pay more attention when there is a regulatory consequence. And equally, from our point of view, that consent process provides an opportunity for, you know, a really good case-by-case sort of analysis of a particular scenario. And as Nick pointed out, there are, in many instances, ways of dealing with issues where you want to undertake activities within proximity to lines. So the consent process perhaps enables that discussion to be had and for methods to be adopted that simply a kind of identification and think about the code kind of framework may not allow that same degree of flexibility.
It's sort of like digging near cables though, isn't it? There's nothing in the plan about digging near cables.
No, I've been in a policy that identifies the code now, of course.
Hmm.
I mean, I think...
If we were minded to include them on the maps with a note that the, whatever the code is, applies to these lines, would that satisfy Aurora's concerns?
It's certainly better than the status quo. I think the key is making people aware of their obligations. So that we would prefer that than nothing. But our most desired approach is the identification plus the rules, because it just gives us more flexibility to actually, I suppose, engage with people when they're undertaking those developments and design solutions and, you know, for particular locations that are going to allow people to do what they want to do but provide the level of protection to Aurora's network that they need.
The other question is in relation to the land use rules that Ms. Dow attached to her evidence. But had she intended that that be presented in the rural stream that she wasn't able to attend, or does she intend to produce them at the utilities hearings?
Yeah, I think she included those so that you could see the sort of suite of provisions that we're hoping to achieve, because they sort of operate in the suite. But we'll be dealing with that in more detail through the network utilities hearing.
And then the 12th September. Yes. Yes. Do you have any further questions? Any questions? Mr. Robinson? Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, one last question. What's the state of health of your client?
Very good, actually. She's up on her feet now, so on crutches. She's sort of got a new piece of apparatus every week.
Yeah.
Yes, I know she's doing very well. Thank you. And I should say thank you very much for accommodating us and those difficulties. It was very much appreciated.
Yeah, she has the same problem in the utility section. Just let us know a couple of weeks in advance. And
certainly. Yeah. Thank you.
We'll adjourn for a few minutes.
A few minutes, the guys are just parking the car, so...
Right. Yeah, we're going to do 20 minutes.
Okay.